Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this Labor Day, September 6th, Monday. Labor Day again, and as the world turns, so does the clock. The time clock, that is. Labor Day pays tribute to the contributions and achievements of American workers. We'll do that today with an eye towards putting the movement back into the labor movement. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Kevin Van Meter, who wrote the book Guerrillas of Desire, Notes on the Everyday Resistance and Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible. He is now working as a union organizer. In his books and articles, Van Meter challenges those who contend that capitalism has been largely successful in domesticating workers. Joe Clement talks with Marianne Garneau about her new piece for Organizing Work, Workplace Struggles Are Political. Marianne Garneau lives in New York, where she is involved in workplace, student, and tenant organizing. This is part one of a two-part discussion. And we'll conclude today's program with Desiree Helligers talking with Hyung Nam, an organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition, a coalition of 24 organizations. They talk about their organizing platform, including support for municipal broadband. I'd like to remind our listeners this morning that the Old Mole is hosting an online photographic retrospective, 30 Years in the Streets of Portland, the Activist Photography of Betty Lee. You can view Betty's photos with her reflections on the KBOO website by searching for Betty Lee, B-E-T-T-E-L-E-E, or by visiting the Old Mole Facebook page. Thanks to our Old Mole, Patricia Kohlberg, for her hard work in support of this important retrospective. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Kevin Van Meter.
Hi, Kevin Van Meter. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Really glad to be here with you today.
Kevin Van Meter is a writer, scholar, wrote the book Guerrillas of Desire, Notes on the Everyday Resistance and Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible. Kevin Van Meter is also an activist. Indeed, works as an organizer, building consciousness and building forces that might transform this country and the planet. So, Kevin, you, among many others who identify as anarchists and a considerable number of Marxists and some left liberals who want to democratize all of life, you're all challenging those who contend that capitalism has been largely successful in domesticating workers, that working class radicalism has been vanquished, that we have to look to others to challenge the capitalist conquerors and the pillagers. You challenge that, reply to that based on your examinations of everyday life and the work that most people do. And what you see, multiple types of resistance that can be the beginning of the springboard for building the kind of movements we need for transforming this country. In this interview, we'll conclude discussing how to organize to build those understandings and commitments. First, though, give us some examples of worker resistance.
So I think there's a range of activities that we could talk about under resistance. Some of those might be highly organized, right? Labor unions, protest activities. But in addition to those activities, there are many, many, many forms of resistance that people utilize in their everyday lives and, of course, at their workplaces in order to create more time for themselves, to create bonds with their fellow workers and the like. So specifically, I'm talking about forms of activity that take place outside the stated political above-ground organizations. That can take many forms, and I've looked at it historically in slave societies, peasant societies, and then what we call both the industrial and then the social factory, so the social service sector, in addition to the industrial factory. And these forms can take many, many different guises. So, for instance, we could look at theft at the workplace, which is a major problem for employers. And we could think about how gig workers and social service workers cooperate on the job in order to make that particular job class or set of tasks less oppressive and allow themselves time to pee. There's an old adage that the the boss makes a dollar, I make a dime, and that's why I poop on company time. And these little moments actually can accumulate, circulate, amplify one another, and lead to more organized forms of resistance.
Yeah, I have the sense that there's all sorts of ways that people try and do jobs really well and really rebel when they know that the job they're doing is shoddy and they're just producing shoddy things, like in Bill Watson's famous essay, Counterplanning on the Shop Floor.
Right. Bill Watson is an interesting figure. As a young man in 1968, he entered the auto factories of Detroit in the Midwest and discovered that outside of the quote-unquote official organizations of the left, that is the political party, the union, nonprofit organization, right, and of course nonprofits developed later, but all those official organizations of the left that supposedly represent workers' interests, but also outside the command of management and the managerial system, Watson was able to see how many forms of organization and cooperation were actually taking place on the shop floor. And that took place in a number of different ways. So for instance, workers would play, right? There was a hose on the factory floor. And then when management and supervisors were not present, they'd spray each other with a hose and take a few moments of themselves to carve out from the workday to have some free joy and expression. Additionally, and I think this really gets to the counterplanning question, is that management has a very particular way through Taylorist and Fordist mechanisms and the factory floor, in kitchens and households, on street corners, wherever work is being performed in order to command that work in the most efficient fashion, right? Moments are profit. Marx outlined quite clearly in Capital Volume 1 that there are three separate ways in which work is imposed and surplus value is created. That's by extending the workday, that's by increasing production through technological usage and hydrocarbons and energy, and then the third is just the intensity of work. And through counterplanning, workers actually address all three of these mechanisms, right? They can decrease the intensity of work by cooperating with one another. They can very often sabotage those machines of production that are being implemented in order to decrease their need in the production process. They can simply steal away moments as that workday is endlessly expanded. And one of the things we've seen with the rise and development of neoliberalism and an entrepreneurial culture and a nonprofit culture over the last 40 years is, in fact, that the workday is extended into all hours of life, right? The only time we are free at work, in fact, is when we're unconscious sleeping. So workers are very often counterplanning, that is, creating different plans outside of the realms of which work is being imposed specifically in a work site. And I think one of the other things I hinted at there in my comment was that the work site is not just simply the factory floor, as Watson outlines. It's also not simply, as I've tried to show in Guerrillas of Desire, both the fields of slaves and peasants is a work site at which massive amounts of resistance take place. But actually, in fact, one of the most important aspects of the last 40, 50 years is the development of the wages for housework movement in 1972. So Watson wrote his essay in 68, published it in 61. And in 1965, Silvia Federici, a feminist scholar, wrote Counterplanning from the Kitchen, of which they looked at the same kind of counterplanning activities that were taking place in Watson's essay in the homes, in the home economic realm of housewives and others. And I think what's important to note here is capitalism requires two base commodities to function. Both of them are energy-based. The first is hydrocarbons, the use of coal, gas, wood, et cetera, in order to use various technological processes to produce more output per hour of worker effort. The other is the energy of labor power. What is being reproduced in the home, in schools, society in general, is labor power. That is the worker's capacity to work. There is no more important commodity for capitalism than labor power. So as Federici and others have noted, when counterplanning takes place in the home, in sites of social reproduction, which is still to this day, even after 50 years of feminist struggle, work that is predominantly performed by women and trans folks, gender nonconforming folks, those outside of the gender binary, are performing this work, and as a direct result, are having a form of work that's imposed upon them that is unwaged. So actually, in fact, if we see labor power as not only a commodity, but a base and one of the most important, if not the most important commodity for the capitalist mode of production and capital accumulation, then interfering, counterplanning in that reproduction of labor power is a key site of struggle. So what that has opened up is to see working class struggle, not just at wage work, but in all that unwaged work.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Oregon, volunteer-powered, listener-supported. Bill Resnick today talking to Kevin Van Meter, an organizer, an activist, a writer. We've been discussing popular resistance by what he has called in his books the commoners and their constant struggle with employers, sometimes just grumbling, sometimes a bit of untraceable sabotage, sometimes cheating a bit, sometimes listening to music, organizing, making requests, demands. Kevin, what's the role of the organizer? What happens to people themselves as the struggle goes on? Because the organizer cannot just herd people at the point of a gun into a room and teach them to repeat the Revolutionary Catechism. Kevin, get concrete on the role of the organizer.
I think there's a lot to be said here. So I want to take a quick step back into the kind of everyday forms of resistance or working class self-activities, various different traditions, anarchist, Marxist, and others, which call attention to this kind of activity that takes place in everyday life. And what I see there is a relationship between spontaneity and organization. Usually on the radical and revolutionary left here in the United States, we see these as dichotomies, right? That you want spontaneity or you want organization. In my view and in the view of the book, I see this activity as actually commingling. And the reason for that is traditionally the difference between medicine and poison was dosage, right? With spontaneity and organization, you need different levels and different dosing of those in a particular context, in a particular work site, in a particular struggle, in order to achieve your goals, right? One of the criticisms made of the labor left here in the United States is that it's commanded by bureaucrats or particular sector of leaders and prevents working class self-activity and spontaneity from taking place, right? By actually doing that, and I believe that that does take place, and I see that in the labor movement currently, it prevents the engagement of workers and other forms of struggle from emerging. Additionally, if you have nothing but spontaneous activity with no coordinated organizing, you can't accomplish certain things. The kind of example that I used to give 10 years ago was info shops, right? If you want to rent a community space and sell books or give out information or have a gathering space, and you try to organize that in a spontaneous fashion, one individual might put their name on the lease for 5 years, rent that space, but there's no organization to keep that place going. Additionally, very often left and radical organizers believe they know what's best or the best form of organization, a political collective, an affinity group, a syndicalist union for a particular form of struggle, and then are surprised that no one joins that organization. There's a reason why most left formulations and left organizations in the United States today have barely a dozen members. And the reason for that is it's not connecting with the everyday lives and the everyday struggles of people themselves. So I think we have to be cognizant of how much organization we need to accomplish our goals. We want to be cognizant of how much spontaneity we need to organize our goals. And we need to do that through collective processes of organizing. And really, the organizer's role there is accompaniment, an accomplice, a facilitator, someone who can provide some historical context and the like in order to help that spontaneity find channels and avenues of action. And of course, part and parcel of revolutionary struggle over the last 500 years is, in fact, finding those strategies and struggles that are successful in the context in which they're operating, and then circulating those lessons to other contexts where they might apply. So, for instance, to go back to the spontaneity organization argument for a second, you don't want a affinity group that is confronting the police to be highly overly organized in such a sense of which there is a command structure waiting for instructions for those spontaneous actors to go out there and confront the police, push back the police line and the like, right? Clearly, there's a form of spontaneity that's needed there, but then organizing and defending those who are arrested by the cops in such an action to do court support, to do legal support, is a different set of strategies of which we need to implement. And it's the hope, it's my hope, that organizers not only see the roles of these various kind of activities, but also provides an historical lens for those who are engaged in those activities, because it's quite difficult to organize after folks are arrested to get legal support and legal funds and the like. In fact, we should be engaged in creating base building operations of which spontaneous struggles that might emerge can be supported by. I think there's another really good recent example, and that's the Black Lives Matter movement. For the last 20 years, really for the last 50 years, there's been a growing development discourse and organizing around police and prison abolition. That has seeded ideas all across the left, especially in communities of color, across the United States. And then as that struggle emerged, were able to take those discourses and that organizing and further their own struggle, right? We cannot predict various kinds of struggle that are going to be emerging, even though I would argue we want to be reading struggles that are emerging. And if we are paying attention to new struggles that are emerging, very often they take forms which we might not necessarily recognize. And it's important that we are attuned to those struggles that are emerging as organizers, as writers, as people who are involved in revolutionary struggle. And I think it also means that we challenge ourselves as organizers to have those difficult conversations. There's a difference between labor organizing and community organizing or radical left organizing, where you're attracting people to your cause, your ideology, or your organization. The difference with labor organizing is it's the boss who's organized the workforce, and it's up to us to deal with each and every individual at that work site or in that workforce in order to engage them in a larger process, either of collective bargaining or striking or taking direct action on the job. And our challenge as organizers is to go beyond our comfort zones in order to find what motivates and drives people, and not just motivate and drives them, but what kind of activities are they engaged in. So I think people are complicated. I don't give a lot of credence to class consciousness as a concept. I'm more interested in how people are organized vis-a-vis capital in the state apparatus, that level of power, and how those things circulate. And I think consciousness is a difficult avenue. And then to point to a particular historical example that will really draw this out, I want to call attention to wartime strikes that took place in the World War II here in the United States. And specifically, the best book on the subject is Marty Glaberman's Wartime Strikes. In the factories that were producing tanks, guns, bullets, et cetera, for the war effort, the unions and the workers themselves were signing no strike pledges, saying that during the war effort, they would not go on strike. And then their wages fell, and then they all went on strike massively. So the same individuals that would wear American flag pin that signed a no strike pledge actually engaged in some of the largest strike activity ever in U.S. history. Now, this stuff is complicated, and the reason it's complicated is because consciousness and people are complicated. So even those who are good, patriotic, white Americans engaged working class men in these factories that were signing no strike pledges and then going on strike, they were also striking to keep particular populations out of the factory and maintain their centralized control over that production process and that union process. And that was excluding people of color, immigrants, women, and others. So these wartime strikes that are taking place are immensely complicated because consciousness is complicated, and why we might want to honor and support and further the struggle to strike against low wages, even when someone has signed a no strike clause, and especially when someone's signed a no strike clause. We want to make sure we're looking at those struggles and how they're furthering the liberation of all.
Kevin, you get the last word, but let me make a semi-provocation. It seems to me that a good organizer can, in fact, bring people to a set of appreciations that underlie any kind of transformatory project. But I think it's sort of incumbent on the organizer to somehow push along that kind of democratic organization of the workers so that they begin appreciating one another's capacities. Anyway, that's my provocation. You get the last word.
Thank you, Bill. And I think that's a good one, right? In my perspective, power educates, right? Labor organizers will often say the boss is the best organizer, especially when the boss is doing something terrible, unjust, claiming poverty and pulling up in a Rolls Royce. So I want to give an example from my own organizing background. Spent some time over the last few months supporting a bargaining team. On the bargaining team, there were two individuals. One was very conservative, biker, supported timber unity, and leans pretty hard right. Another bargaining team member is a queer woman, engaged currently to a trans woman, and is very out about those kind of experiences and struggles and the importance of supporting queer workers at this particular workplace. These are two individuals that are ideologically opposed, who very often would not have engaging conversation, but working together on that bargaining team, they're now confronting power and being educated in the fact that they have more in common as low-wage workers at this particular workplace than they have with the boss itself, right? Or with white supremacist ideology or the gender binary or patriarchal systems. That actually, in fact, that power has educated them in that confrontation with power about their common needs. And I think those are important moments of which we need to help support and facilitate, because we're not going to convince people by a strong argument, by a meme, by a post, by a well-crafted argument or insult. We're going to change the power relationships by organizing to build power among the working class people of various backgrounds, and then confronting the power of the boss of the work site, the husband at the home, et cetera, et cetera.
Kevin Van Meter, keep up the good work. Check out Kevin's website and his books. Why don't you give him the information, Kevin?
Certainly. My book from 2017 is called Guerrillas of Desire, Notes on Everyday Resistance and Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible. It's available from akpress.com. And my personal website is readingstruggles.info. And Reading Struggles is the title of the book that I'm currently working on now. And I look forward to sharing that with you, Bill, and your listeners.
Right. Thanks a lot. Let's talk again.
Thank you. And I look forward to those conversations.
That was the Busboys' American Worker. Before that, you heard Bill Resnick and Kevin Van Meter discussing worker resistance. Stay tuned to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour to hear Desiree Helligers and Hyung Nam, organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition, discussing municipal broadband. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio. Next on The Old Mole, Joe Clement and Marianne Garneau talk workplace struggles. This is part one of a two-part interview. Joe?
I'm Joe Clement for The Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined again today by Marianne Garneau. Marianne's become something of a regular guest on The Old Mole over the last few years, coming on to talk about workplace organizing and related issues in the labor movement. She's an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, the chair of the IWW's Education Department, and publisher of the online journal Organizing Work. The URL for that is just organizing.work. Welcome back to The Old Mole, Marianne.
Thanks for having me again.
So today's Labor Day in the United States, a contentious holiday among radicals in the labor movement because it's seen to compete with May Day or International Workers' Day. And personally, I think it's better to have more days on the calendar celebrating the labor movement than fewer. But I recognize why this Labor Day has associations with what's wrong in the labor movement. So in light of that, I'd like to talk about one of the latest articles on organizing work titled Workplace Struggles Are Political, as well as some debatable developments in American class struggle. Now, your article comments on how labor struggles, particularly in the workplace or at the so-called point of production, are treated as not really political or subordinate to more properly political agendas defined by political, usually socialist parties. Now, what led you to write this one, and who are you exactly criticizing for taking these positions?
So I was immediately responding to a piece by Sam Gindin, who is a Canadian, he's like a socialist, he's worked for the Social Democratic Party up there and some unions, and it written in The Nation, and also a piece written by Kim Moody. But really, this is a view that you find everywhere. And once you see it, you kind of can't unsee it, and you start seeing it everywhere. The idea basically is that, look, workers need to have unions, workplaces should be organized. Obviously, workers need some kind of protection against their employers. Plus, the working class should be institutionally organized into some kind of entity. But really, politics is something that takes place outside of the workplace. So if you lean towards being like a Democrat, let's say in the US, then you think that politics takes place maybe at elections, through voting in the right candidates, through policy craft. If you're more radical leaning, if you're more of a socialist leaning political person, then you think that politics takes place in terms of gathering everybody into a radical political party, crafting political ideology and positions on things, but the commonality is basically viewing the struggles over the control of work that take place in the workplace as not inherently political in and of themselves.
Just to clarify, Kim Moody is who?
Kim Moody is one of the founders of Labor Notes. He's a socialist, and Labor Notes, of course, is a wonderful project. It delivers really exceptionally good educational materials that workers and union officials can use to struggle better and stronger at work. Always been a fan of the project. But what's really interesting is that even people who are dedicated to workplace organizing and have dedicated in some ways their lives and careers to workplace organizing, there's still this idea that, you know, there's a limit to what really can be accomplished there. As I point out in my article, it's an idea that has a very long socialist pedigree going all the way back to Lenin. Unions are an entity that can fight over certain limited sort of issues, but we don't really see the struggle between workers and employers in the workplace as having political content in and of itself. We see that as being important, maybe, on this view, but we don't see that as being really significant, which is why you ultimately need something like a political party in order to get into real politics.
Now, at one point in the article, you write, funny enough, the socialist idea, the workplace is apolitical, reflects the dominant view in capitalist society. The owners of capitalist society would like us to see politics as its own sphere of activity, completely separate from the economy, which unfolds on its own logic. What do you think is important to understand about what this separation is, how it's being made, and what it means for connecting workplace struggle with broader struggles to transform society?
Well, this is sort of the funny thing, is that you are not supposed to consider it a political matter that you report to work and get told what to do, that the hierarchy is basically very vertical, very top down. You have bosses, maybe they have bosses. Ultimately, the people who own things in society get to make decisions about how those things are used and when and where. The way we are conditioned in capitalist society is not to see those things as up for debate and not to see them as possibly being different. And the dominant, basically, view in our society is that work is just, that's just a thing, and politics is separate from it. Politics is something that you exercise at the ballot box, or maybe you exercise in the streets. But work is just, that's just the way that things are. Whereas, obviously, one of the goals of organizing should be to get workers to look at their working conditions and realize that there is a power hierarchy and a power struggle there between them and their employers, and then fight to reverse that, fight to increase their own power as much as possible and take away as much power from the boss as possible.
And you even note that recognizing this separation goes as far back as Marx himself. What exactly does he note about this, and why do you think that it gets lost?
So one of the things Marx pointed out was that we had revolutions, let's say, in the 17th, 18th centuries. We had new constitutions drawn up, which gave people more freedom. It gave them more individual rights and more freedom. And we left feudal society behind, where you were, for example, a serf or a peasant, and that was your lot in life, and that determined what your political station was at the same time as your economic station. Instead, we had these revolutions where we decoupled economics from politics, where we said, look, it doesn't matter who you are in society, it doesn't matter how impoverished you are, you too have enfranchisement, citizenship, you have the right to vote, you have other political rights. And when we divorced economics and politics like that, on some level, it gave people more freedom. But on another level, it basically depoliticized economics. So we decided as a society that we weren't really going to do anything about the continuing unfreedom and exploitation that exists in the economy. And that's true today, right? So if you are exploited at work, that's not considered a political problem. In fact, most of us don't even get to the point of framing that as exploitation, but whoever you are, it's not your boss being mean to you. You are producing more than you're actually taking home. That's why they employ you, right? But we are not encouraged to see that as political. We are not encouraged to, we don't have a political system that intervenes in that. So Marx's point was that, look, you can free people in terms of civil rights and free them formally, politically, but that doesn't necessarily free them on an economic level and on a deep social level. And it doesn't actually uproot inequality and exploitation that exists. So he was already noticing this then, and it's a situation we continue with today. And the irony is that now people who are socialists kind of repeat this when they think that that workplace struggles aren't political, that true politics takes place inside of a political party, et cetera, et cetera.
So jumping to the end of the article, you identify this series of issues that you consider politically important, but that radicals in the labor movement seem to have dismissed. I'll list them off and then ask you to explain a bit about each of them and how or why they're getting dismissed and what it would look like to take them more seriously. The first is the difference between recognition as a formality, thanks to legal mechanisms, versus the de facto recognition of workers being able to wrest concessions. Constraints on workers' ability to engage in economically disruptive action in the form of no-strike clauses. The trade-off between the right to strike and a formal grievance process that ends in arbitration. The capacity to settle grievances on the floor using disruptive action. Constraints on worker control over work in the form of management rights clauses, whether the written contract frames what workers are entitled to, or whether they take on issues before those four corners during the life of the contract, where and by whom decision-making about engaging the employer takes place, and how broadly inclusive those decision-making bodies are, and what union member engagement looks like today. So, in what ways first, could you explain a bit about some of these items and how they're getting dismissed and what you and the other contributors to organizing work propose to take them seriously?
So that's basically a list of things that, to my mind, make significant differences with respect to how much power workers can actually exercise in the workplace, and therefore how effectively they can fight employers. So in all the discussion within the labor movement, in the debate within the labor movement, you very seldom see people take on something like, for example, management's rights clauses. Now, management's rights clauses are written into virtually every contract. It's like the main reason why employers sign them. It's the first thing that they are looking for. And it basically says anything outside of this contract that we have explicitly spelled out is the prerogative of the employer, right? They run the workplace. They own the workplace. They decide what, when, where, how. They decide, they make decisions in terms of production, in terms of the pace of work, and et cetera. And that is entirely to them. Workers do not have the right to basically decide how things go in the workplace. That's not really talked about very much. I mean, if you actually sat most people in the labor movement down and brought up management rights clauses, they'd be like, yeah, they're crappy. You know, that it's a bad thing. Here's how it harms workers and so on and so forth. So instead you see debates about, for example, who should be elected to union leadership positions and why it is important that socialists be elected to leadership positions. Or you see a lot of hand-wringing about how with the Taft-Hartley Act passed in the late 40s, communists and socialists were kicked out of unions, and therefore that's why they are no longer as effective and no longer as radical and no longer as militant. There's very little attention paid to the other evolution that happened in the labor movement towards, for example, every contract containing a management rights clause, every contract containing a no-strike clause. So that means the workers will not strike during the life of the contract. Every contract spelling out a way of resolving workplace issues, in other words, grievances, that basically takes place away from the workplace, now increasingly between kind of paid experts on either side. So staff working for the union and then lawyers or whoever working for the company, which ultimately drives towards arbitration. In other words, it's kind of a legalistic procedure where an allegedly neutral third party comes in and hands down a final decision. Very, very disempowering for workers, very disinclusive of workers. But those things aren't really debated very much. They're not problematized very much. Instead, we talk about who the leaders of the labor movement should be in this abstract sense. Like, we need people who think more radically to be put in charge, as though that suddenly matters.
I think that also just reflects the not necessarily radical worker perception that our unions are doing something for us by virtue of sitting at the table with the boss, and the people who sit at that table as the union are the leaders, and that if we want them to do right by us, we have to control who we're putting in that seat. But you're saying, and have been for as long as you've been coming on the Old Mole, that workers themselves need to be at the forefront of that decision-making process and actually be taking on the bosses themselves.
Yes, they do. And there are different ways of even believing in that, right? So sometimes, I mean, a lot of people say things like, well, workers are the ones who should be in charge and workers should be leading and whatever, but that means different things to different people. To some, it just means that, you know, you should have a certain pedigree before you take the reins of power or something like that. But what I'm interested in is how the actual workers in a workplace can deploy the leverage that they have by virtue of being the workers in that workplace to get their needs and demands met. So I believe in control over work on an immediate day-to-day level, and workers wielding that themselves without a reliance on a more bureaucratic procedure that takes place away from the shop floor, as we call it. And there are a lot of people who, in the labor left world, who will criticize the bureaucratization of unions. Unions have become these stuffy bureaucracies, but they don't actually believe in, for example, doing away with the grievance process as it currently exists. So again, I think some things are really politically significant and they don't necessarily get treated that way.
And if we think about it, the power that you're talking about reconstituting is the only basis there ever was for the labor movement. After the National Labor Relations Act, there became this increasingly prevalent idea that labor law and these legal mechanisms would protect workers, because there's this idea that the law itself is about protecting people in society rather than just organizing them in some way. And that as we've gotten away from that perspective on where the power really is, we don't even understand why things aren't working.
Yeah, absolutely. And this gets back to that big politics question too, right? Like, what is our leverage in society as workers? Is it at the ballot box? Is that the significance of the working class? Just that they constitute a lot of voters? You know, that doesn't seem like that much leverage. You know, if you look at, for example, very wealthy and the business class, they don't necessarily seem to care that much about who gets elected. Like, they know that they have ways of exercising power that don't depend on getting the right person into office. And I think that's very telling. Whereas we think that somehow if we elect the right people, things will start tilting in our favor. That's never really been the case.
That was Ruby Rain with Roll Out the Pickets. Before that, you heard Joe Clement and Marianne Garneau in the first part of a two-part discussion on workplace struggles. We conclude today's program with Desiree Helgers talking with Hyung Nam, an organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition, a coalition of 24 organizations, and they're talking today about support for municipal broadband. Desiree?
My guest today is Hyung Nam, who's an organizer with Portland Metro People's Coalition. And Hyung has been involved in a full range of organizing efforts in the city, and in his not-so-spare time, works as a teacher at Ida B. Wells High School, which until recently was named after Woodrow Wilson, the 28th president of the United States, a white supremacist who enthusiastically screened Birth of a Nation at the White House. And Hyung played no small role in the movement to rename the school. So much respect for that important organizing work, Hyung.
Thank you.
Portland Metro People's Coalition, or PMPC, is a coalition of 24 community organizations, including, among others, AFSCME Local 88, the Alliance for Democracy, Portland chapter of the DSA, Sunrise Movement, PDX, Right to Survive, and many others. PMPC has developed a shared policy platform and also a Bill of Rights rooted in building intersectional community power to advance a vision of the city where, quote, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color and other marginalized people don't have to fear violence from police or white supremacists, where people's homes are safe and healthy to live in, and where everyone can be secure in their housing, food, and water, and mental well-being. A city that takes public health, environmental, and changing climate consequences seriously and acts at the scale that those challenges demand. So PMPC has been actively involved in the city's charter review process, and one aspect of that work focuses around expanding and protecting the Portland City Commons with three areas of focus in particular, including municipal broadband, public banks, land trusts slash surplus property acquisition. So Hyung, can you tell us more about this quite visionary agenda? And it seems like in the age of pandemics, when low income and disproportionately BIPOC students are marginalized by limited internet access, and many people are working from home, municipal broadband has never been as important as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've been working on for a while now. And from my perspective in PMPC, it's really part of what people like Barb Perovitz talks about, community wealth building. He talks about it in this kind of a way to make it less sectarian. I mean, of course, we could call it socialism as well in many ways. But I think, you know, to overcome maybe people's ideological discomfort with that, I think if you talk about it in that kind of a way, it really is very practical. I mean, to the point where, you know, the only public bank that exists in the United States right now is in North Dakota. And granted that it was started by populists and socialists, North Dakotans that are far from socialist today very much embrace the public bank and know how well it works, and know the value of having a public enterprise that provides a valuable service to people and actually generates revenue that would be lost to out-of-state corporations and investors. And it's not only a matter of community wealth building and avoiding that kind of extraction of our local wealth and resources, but it's also about how enterprises are run. Are they run for the benefit of the people and the workers, or they run to cut costs to pad profits for investors and salaries for executives. And I think it's part of a different vision of our world that sees a reduced, if not no role for capitalism, and where we can see that economically in the United States, especially, you know, throughout the Cold War, there was such a heavy ideology contrasting in a really distorted way so-called democracy versus communism. And this notion that somehow political democracy, given the huge inequalities of capitalism and the tendencies towards oligarchy and plutocracy, that somehow we could have democracy under capitalism. And I mean, and this is why we thought it was important to intervene in the Charter Commission, because the big focus has been changing the form of government and elections and thinking that, well, that's going to give us, you know, better democracy. Most other cities have a city manager, strong mayor, they have district elections, all kinds of things, or even, you know, ranked choice elections. And democracy is still very much challenged in all those places because we have such extreme economic inequality that undermines any kind of democratic society where people might vote once every 2 or 4 years, but they spend more than 40 hours a week working under a dictatorship, under capitalism. And we as ratepayers or consumers have very little choice with these oligopolies that dominate, that provide services that we cannot live without.
So really thinking about these as public utilities.
All over the world, there are places that have had utilities privatized and now are in the process of re-municipalizing or renationalizing it. Like France had a lot of their water privatized. Right now, there are private equity companies that are targeting municipal water systems. This all fits into the neoliberal world, right? Where they cut taxes, both federal and local taxes, you know, with Prop 13 movement being the huge example that set off this anti-tax movement. And so you starve the public and public services to the point where they can't really maintain their infrastructure and services. And then we're not seeing the kind of investments that we need to see from both federal and local governments in infrastructure, partly because, especially on a local level, less so on a federal level, there is a lack of will to raise taxes and raise revenue. So you have public facilities just crumble, and then private investors come in, promise that they can make the investments to keep these things running. And that's the constant threat that we face.
Yeah, and it seems like nationally, municipal broadband has really been making some serious headway. And in Portland, I know that municipal broadband, PDX, right, which arose in 2017 in the wake of the striking down of net neutrality, commissioned or helped organize the county to commission a feasibility study, which came out in September 2020. Can you talk a little bit, you know, about some of the headway that's been made on broadband?
Is the sound?
There was just a little crackle. It could be my internet connection, Hyung.
Okay.
Right. I mean, and I think that's a really critical piece of the municipal broadband picture, right, is bringing in fiber optic cables that they're like 40 times faster than kinds of connections that we have today. I mean, it's ironic, right, that even in the course of doing this interview over Zoom, we're experiencing the kind of unpredictability of the connection, which as both of us are teachers. You know, if you're trying to teach online and you've got an unstable internet connection, it's a major issue.
Yeah, we had to change our services twice because it was just always so slow. I mean, we had originally decent, you know, fast broadband for download, but the upload was too slow and that messed us up. So yeah, we have fiber and we pay much more than we would under municipal broadband system, as we hope to have here in Portland and as they do have in many other places where they have top quality service and pay lower fees. And then on top of it, those fees go towards public revenue to the point where they're able to subsidize low income or, you know, schools or whomever, so that they could either provide the service for free or drastic reduction in price. And everyone else pays less than we would to the major oligopolies. And that is still enough to subsidize free or majorly discounted services for everyone, and to make sure that nobody's left behind.
So already, Sandy,
yeah. Mountain,
Independence, Oregon. I mean, 2018, Kate Brown created an Oregon broadband office specifically focused on implementing broadband across the state, especially in underserved rural and urban areas. So this is not some impossible vision, right? It's happening all over the country, and it can happen.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, you know, with public utilities in general, I think we have to remember that in many parts of the country, including, you know, red states, they have public electricity. I forget, is it Tennessee is one of the places where it's the largest public electricity services? In fact, I think the entire state might be completely public. But I believe in Washington for electricity, 70% is public. In Oregon, 30% is public. And in Oregon for electricity, we with PGE or Pacific Power pay a higher than the state's average for our electricity, whereas the publicly owned or cooperatively owned electric providers pay less than the state average. It's such a no-brainer. And it's not like we're thinking of, you know, some crazy utopian scheme. Public utilities have existed in this country and other countries for quite a while. Many places, including red states, especially because, you know, rural places, right? Rural places, whether it's broadband or electricity, a lot of corporations just, it wasn't worth it for them. I mean, they had such a big market in urban centers that it wasn't worth it for them to provide services there. And so a lot of rural places were kind of forced to create public or cooperative systems because the corporations wouldn't do it. And ironically, you know, they have better services at a lower cost because of that.
Mm-hmm. So the data in Multnomah County, right, shows that 15% of Portland area households do not have internet access at home. And for households earning under $30,000, that percentage goes up to about 18%. For people who are over age 65, it's 28%. And for Hispanic households, it's 30%. Yeah. So digital inequality is a huge issue in Multnomah County.
Yeah. And even the service that they do have is often pretty poor service. I mean, even some of my colleagues during the pandemic Zooming in faculty meetings, I could not hear them because their upload speeds were too slow. So I can't imagine, it wasn't just our students, even faculty members struggled with internet connection, especially if you have more than one household member that's using the service at the same time, which was often the case. So we really have inferior quality and we pay much more for it. And again, because the priorities of investor-owned utilities is not providing the best service at the best price. It is taking advantage of an oligopoly where they know people have very little choice. They can charge whatever they feel like it and make sure their executives make plenty of money, exploit their workers, often contracted workers, and make sure they make plenty of profits to lobby, to keep the laws nationally and locally in their favor and make all kinds of deals with politicians and so forth.
We're coming up again on an election cycle, or, you know, at some point we're already looking forward to the next presidential election. And we know that if a Republican gets in, that the likelihood of net neutrality going down is profound, right? And that's going to have incredible implications for circulation of information. And so municipal broadband would be able to preserve access to information across the board without the kind of practice of throttling and marginalizing left media. I mean, we're not seeing the marginalization of right-wing media. We're seeing the marginalization of left-wing media and of media that's really looking at expanding the common.
Net neutrality is not an issue that I've taken deep dives on, but I think just with cooperative or publicly owned enterprises and utilities, you know, I should say that they're not automatically perfect, right? Because democracy is imperfect. And as long as we live under global capitalism, things are always a challenge. I mean, for instance, you know, whether it's the democratic process or even cooperatives, I mean, many of us belong to cooperatives, including credit unions, but many of us are not very active in them, right? I mean, technically we all have, or even our unions, right? I mean, all these kinds of systems allow for democratic participation. We get to vote on the board of directors, which is very different from investor-owned enterprises and corporations where we have no vote. I mean, you know, technically they say you vote with your dollar, which is a joke. But there are people even in the democratic political process that may not participate because they have, under capitalism, they have to work 60 hours a week to pay rent and they don't have time to be informed and they feel cynical under capitalist plutocracy that their vote's not going to make a difference. So I should say that just having cooperative or public utilities doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have economic democracy, but it's a step towards it. And right. Without them, economic democracy is really impossible.
Okay, and we're also talking about money that's going out of the community, and municipal broadband would keep that money in the community. So we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'm just wondering if you can tell us, like, how can people plug into this organizing? How can we support it? How can people who really, really appreciate the idea of municipal broadband and public banks, right? I mean, you know, that's a multi-tiered platform that we're talking about. How can people plug in?
I think the best way to plug in is to contact PMPC. They can go to our website, which is portlandpeoplescoalition.org, and they can email us there to find out with several organizations, including 350 PDX, Sunrise, Climate Action Coalition, et cetera. And so we are involved in the public charter commission meetings and the subcommittee meetings that are going to be happening as well. Right now, there are subcommittees for form of government, elections, and enhancing democracy. And public utilities can really fit under enhancing democracy. They could also fit as part of environmental justice for a lot of different reasons as well. But we do want a separate dedicated subcommittee on environmental justice. All these things really work together. Just having municipal broadband would be great. But if we could have municipal broadband and municipal power, like a lot of places, electric co-ops are actually providing the resources to create municipal or cooperative broadband as well. And if we combine that with a public bank with the huge amount of money that we would save money on the bonds for the building the infrastructure, I mean, it would create kind of a whole economic development engine to envision all kinds of things that we normally are told we could never afford, right?
We'll definitely have to have you back on. We'll definitely be talking more with people from the Portland Metro People's Coalition and this really important platform that we really hope people will get behind. Yesterday has been Hyung Nam, who's an organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition. Thank you so much, Hyung.
This has been Desiree Helgers for the Oldmoor Variety Hour.
That was Kraftwerk, Computer Love. Before that, we heard Desiree Helgers and Hyung Nam discussing Portland Metro People's Coalition and the importance of municipal broadband. For more on the subject, we will link to Bill Resnick's 2019 interview with data engineer Michael Hanna, volunteer campaign manager for the Municipal Broadband PDX. In kind, they discuss how municipal broadband is cheap, democratic, forces firms to compete, and can preserve net neutrality. You've been listening to the Oldmoor Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio, and a big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over the last year. It takes a labor. The Oldmoor comes to you every Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks to our contributors and guests this morning for making this show possible. Bill Resnick, Kevin Van Meter, Desiree Helgers, Hyung Nam, and Joe Clement and Marianne Garneau. You can hear the Oldmoor on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Oldmoor Variety Hour, or download the Oldmoor podcast and listen on the go. I'm Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective.